One thing one learns is to believe nothing. The only thing I believe is the Bible. And I've learned to believe the spirit of prophecy. But after that, everything you hear, you must check. Even if your loving grandmother tells you, you've got to check. Years ago, I read a book by B.G. Wilkinson called Truth Triumphant. Many moons ago, I got to know a bit about him, his children afterwards. But in this book, he traced the observance of the Sabbath in several parts of the world. And one of the parts of the world was Britain. So in 1943, I was asked to go and be pastor of the church in Edinburgh in Scotland, and to hold an evangelistic campaign in that very beautiful ancient city. We rented the Usher Hall, which is another nice building, huge building in the middle of town, and we moved from there to the Masonic Hall, eventually to the church that we bought, a congregational church in Bristow Place, just near the University of Edinburgh. The National Library of Scotland was available to me. It used to be called the Advocates Library then. And so I loved libraries, and I spent all the time I could in that library reading. B.G. Wilkinson had mentioned Skeen and Burton and a few other authors who had written about the early observance of the Sabbath in Scotland. So I looked up their books, and when I gave out my sermons and literature that was mimeographed, I put the name and title and author and the call number of the book. So if they want to check it up, go there and ask the young lady, fill in a slip, borrow it, see the evidence. I came to the United States in 1946, the end of August, and walked into what was then the seminary and met an old school chum of mine coming out full of happiness. He had just got his M.A. And we discussed his thesis. In his thesis, he had established that Ellen White had made a mistake. Well, that was kind of arresting. Great Controversy, page 62. In Great Britain, primitive Christianity had very early taken root. The gospel received by the Britons in the first century was then uncorrupted by Romish apostasy. Persecution from pagan emperors, which extended even to these far-off shores, was the only gift that the first churches of Britain received from Rome. Many of the Christians fleeing from persecution in England found refuge in Scotland. Thence the truth was carried to Ireland, and in all these countries it was received with gladness. When the Saxons invaded Britain, heathenism gained control. The conquerors disdained to be instructed by their slaves, and the Christians were forced to retreat to the mountains and the wild moors. Yet the light, hidden for a time, continued to burn. In Scotland, a century later, it shone out with a brightness that extended to far distant lands. From Ireland came the pious Columba and his co-laborers, who, gathering about them the scattered believers on the lonely island of Iona, made this the center of their missionary labors. Among these evangelists was an observer of the Bible Sabbath, and thus the truth was introduced among the people. A school was established at Iona from which missionaries went out not only to Scotland and England, but to Germany, Switzerland, and even Italy. But Rome had fixed her eyes on Britain and resolved to bring it under her supremacy. In the 6th century, her missionaries undertook the conversion of the heathen Saxons. They were received with favor by the pious barbarians, and they induced many thousands to profess the Romish faith. As the work progressed, the papal leaders and their converts encountered the primitive Christians. Striking contrast was presented. The latter were simple, humble, scriptural in character, doctrine, and manners, while the former manifested the superstition, pomp, and arrogance of popery. The emissary of Rome demanded that these Christian churches acknowledge the supremacy of the sovereign pontiff. Britons meekly replied that they desired to love all men, but that the Pope was not entitled to supremacy in the church, and they could render to him only the submission which was due to every follower of Christ. Repeated attempts were made to secure their allegiance to Rome, but these humble Christians, amazed at the pride displayed by her emissaries, steadfastly replied that they knew no other master than Christ. Now the true spirit of the papacy was revealed. Said the Romish leader, "If you will not receive brethren who bring you peace, you shall receive the enemies who will bring you war. If you will not unite with us in showing the Saxons the way of life, you shall receive from them the stroke of death." These were no idle threats. War, intrigue, deception were employed against these witnesses for a Bible faith until the churches of Britain were destroyed or forced to submit to the authority of the Pope. Let me tell you, that is the most succinct, accurate appraisal of 400 years of history that I've ever read in my life. I spent years researching that area. I've read that thing 100 times. When I finished and took every sentence in that, I wouldn't alter a word. Knowing all the pitfalls in history, knowing all the areas of problem, and I thought to myself, that is a third grade dropout who wrote that. Or did she? Well, now, this little discussion, they didn't keep the Sabbath. Now, he had his MA and I didn't have my MA, so I didn't argue with him. I don't like to argue with people anyway. Tell them what you think. They're of age. If they don't like it, love them. Leave them. So I thought about that. That was 46. I wondered what all those statements were that Skene had made and Burton had made and all the rest of them had made regarding the observance of the Sabbath, but I was in no position to debate it. And then time passed by and it became necessary for me to get some sort of a degree to decorate a college calendar, so I had to work toward a degree. And I thought it would be fun to work in Johns Hopkins and so on. Dr. Albright gave me a scholarship there, which was nice because it didn't cost anyone anything. And so I studied there for 2 years. It was called the Johns Hopkins, the Oriental Seminary, they called it then. We studied mainly Semitic languages and history. Many languages, all of which were allied to Hebrew. Well, after 2 years of that, I could take it no longer. It disgusted me. So I'm a university dropout. I remember coming down old Baltimore from Washington, no freeways in those days, stopping not far from where the Spencerville Church now is, pulling off in my little old Ford car and having a chat with the Lord. I couldn't take it. It was brainwashing. Nothing in the Bible meant what it said. You showed your smarts by improving it, known as emendations. Oh, if you get the Ethiopic from this, you can get this. And if you get the Ugaritic from that, you can get that. If you get the Syriac from that, you can get that. And if you get the Arabic from that, you can get that. Nothing was what it said. And I had enough. So I quit. I said to the Lord, if you want me to study and get a degree anywhere, you arrange it. Well, arrangements were made. And I had the opportunity to teach at Newbold. And so my brother had gone there to med school in 1920, much older than I. And so I thought I'd go to King's College and get into the University of London and see if I could work on a doctor's program, which I did. And then I decided I was going to write on these two pages of great controversy. And the title that I finally came up was The Beliefs and Practices of the Celtic Church in Britain. Every word of which I labored through to get that title. See, it's Big Britain, Great Britain, Little Britain, Brittany, across in France. So you've got to define what Britain is. It includes the Isles and, of course, takes in Scotland and Wales and Ireland. See, to a Scotsman, England is a peninsula jutting south from Scotland. And so there's Scotland and Wales and Ireland and England, which are all United Kingdom, pretty united, like the United States. Some Irishmen are not quite as united as they might be. But this business has been going on. The first fight between Northern Ireland and Southern Ireland took place in 629 AD. I can footnote that from the Annals of Ireland. So my studies took in the beliefs and practices of the Celtic Church. Now there are some ignorant people in Boston who call their ball team Celtic. But the original people spelt their name with a K. So it's not the Celtic Church in Britain, it's the Celtic Church in Britain, although the team is Celtics, whatever you want to call them. The Celts were the original inhabitants. Very little is known about the Celts. And I soon discovered, as I had surmised before, that history is a myth we choose to believe. Now, if Molly was sitting here, she'd say, be careful, Les, don't get too cynical. Don't get too cynical. But you don't believe anything you read till you got the right footnote under it. Then you check the footnote. And you make sure that the fellow that quotes the footnote quotes it correctly. So I wanted to get a picture of the early Christians. Now she says Christianity got a foothold in England early. Nobody knows when or how. Archaeology has found traces. Not far from Newbold is the foundation of a church. 213 or so, they guess. They've covered it up now because it was disintegrating, the stonework and all. It had to be kept. So they've got surveyed it and everything, and you can see from the top they got a model, but they wanted to preserve it, and so it's covered with a couple of feet of sod. It's down there. Remnants of a church in southern Scotland, very early, who knows how early. The first real bits of Christianity that you get is the writing of a man called Patrick. Patrick was a Scotsman. He was born about 30 miles south of the city of Glasgow. He wrote a little book called Confessions and another smaller one called The Letter to Caroticus. Very early. He tells us his father was an elder and his grandfather was a deacon in the church. So there was a church there. There was a little group of Christians. When he was in his late teens, he was captured by some Irish pirates. They needed forced labor and they took him over to Ireland, and there he probably helped in a farm that bred Irish hounds that were very popular in Europe. And on one time he was sent with a cargo of these hounds in a boat that landed in Brittany. And then we're going overland. There he escaped from the people that he was working for and wound his way back across the English Channel up into Ireland. Somehow at that time he became impressed that he ought to work for Christ. And in his little book he says he had a dream. He could see the youth of Irish saying, "Come over and help us." And he decided to go over and help the Irish. He found, as he says, his little book, you know, you can get it, it's in English, it was written in Latin, but it's in English. Little book, maybe 25, 30 pages long, full of the Bible. Full of the Bible. Many, many quotes. He believes in the second coming of Christ with all the text he quotes. And he quotes an old Bible, an Itala. An Itala Bible preceded Jerome's Vulgate. So it means that the Christians who came there to Scotland came before Jerome translated his Bible. So they were there before 300. And they brought that Bible, which is sometimes called the African Bible, came over North Africa, probably over Gibraltar, through Spain, up through France and Brittany, and then across the English Channel. There was some way they came in. And he begins to work for them. And they begin to accept Christ. Now this is about 375 AD. This is about the time it happened, give or take a decade or so. Now, what did he believe? Well, his biographers later, and Patrick has got many biographers, 200 years apart, and those biographies differ very greatly. Now, as Ellen White said, she didn't give the date, 6th century, 596 A.D., Augustine, sent from Rome, landed on the island of Thanet in Britain. Now, Patrick was, say, 375 to 400. This was nearly 200 years later. Now, in between, she says, the Saxons came. Now, the Picts from the north began to fight. The English and the Welsh and all the rest of it, they're fighters, always been fighters. And so some of the English sent over to Germany to invite the Saxons to come to help them fight the Picts. And so the Saxons came and pushed the Picts north and then took over England, just as she says. The heathen then overran. Now this come, they came about 450. So you're in 400, 450, 600, 596, the Catholics come. When the Catholics come, as she says here, and you get Bede and everyone, many people, establishing the fact that they found a group of Christians. Now, these are the simple facts. Now, I don't know what you've got in your mind, but how many people are we dealing with? How many people were there in England? How many people were there in Ireland? How many people were there in Scotland? I spent weeks and weeks trying to do a demographic study of the population of Britain in those days. And you can't do it, but you can extrapolate. Say in 1066, remember the Frenchman William conquered Harold, shot him at Hastings, took over Britain, conquered Britain, 1066. And then he wrote a book called Doomsday Book. Sounds terrible, Doomsday. But doom in the 11th century means a sort of destiny. And so it describes a life. And he found the population in the whole of Britain, as far as he could find, just over 1 million. So how many people were in Ireland? And then you go back 500 years before, and you say, how many people were in Ireland? So my guess, which all historians have to do, they don't always are honest enough to call them a guess, but the conclusion, based on the evidence, doesn't that sound much more learned? My guess is that there might have been 60, 70,000 people in Ireland. I think that's a big number. And about the same number in Scotland. So you're not dealing with millions of people. So when you get historians saying that the Celtic missionaries swarmed over Europe, you have to say, come on, what sort of language you used? Swarm indicates how many? 20? I think if they were 20, they were a lot. Maybe 30. But they make a tremendous impression. So he established Christianity in Ireland. There he taught them the gospel. One of his earliest biographers said, wherever Patrick went, he left a book of the law and a book of the gospel. That's a peculiar statement in Latin. A book of the law and a book of the gospel. They're there. Now, what are these? A part of the fun I had doing this study was to try to establish a point that the book of the law was still extant. In fact, there are four copies. Four copies. And the book of the law is called in Latin Liber Ex Lege Moisi. Liber is book, ex is out of, lege is the law, and Moisi is Moses. So the title that the manuscript has is The Book Extracted from the Law of Moses. Starts with the Ten Commandments. Nobody has ever published it. So I had fun trying to do that, appendix in my book, making an analysis of this book, of this Liber Ex Lege. It's not very big. A long manuscript made of some kind of animal hide. Part of the manuscript's got a hole in it that you can stick your finger right into it. And I thought, that's where the arrow got this poor little animal. But it's there, and they write right up to it and write by the side of it. It's all written by hand. And so I got a photocopy of the thing and analyzed it. Takes all the references to the Sabbath in the Pentateuch. Then it's got a section on clean and unclean meats. Then it's got a section on cities of refuge. Then it's got another section all on the sex laws that he carries out. Little sections. It's a book excerpted from the law of Moses. And I thought, this is interesting. This is what Patrick took. Wherever he went, he left it. There are four of them alive still. One is in the Louvre. The one I looked at was in Cambridge. And a couple in the British Museum. British Museum is very difficult to take care of because you've got to park about 60 miles away. So to get to it is a pain and a pain. So it was much easier to drive 120 miles to Cambridge where you can park anywhere you want and go in there and get it and look at it and go back. So they're there, they're all the same. This means that Patrick was Bible-based, and he also gave a book of the law, a book of the Gospels, and I think there is one copy of that still extant. I didn't push that in my dissertation, but I think it's still there. It is the old Gospels upon which the kings and queens of Britain have taken their oath of office for millennia, 1,200 years. It's a tiny little handwritten gospel, book of the Gospels, most valuable gospels that they have in Britain, all written meticulously by hand. So the Liber Ex Lege Moisi, I'm sure, of the book of the law, and I think that's one of the book of the gospel. So wherever he went, Patrick Now the Saxons came in and pushed, took over. and began to the Christians who were there, persecuted by the heathen, as she says, which can be documented historically, went down to Cornwall and into Wales and up into southwest Scotland. And that's where Patrick's family happened to be. There were Christians there. They went in that area. Then the pressures came, more and more of them. And after Augustine came, 596, for the next 50 years, Christianity was almost exterminated in Britain. In 664, the Council of Whitby, you may have heard of that in old church history, on the west eastern coast of England, upper ways. By the way, they found a seal, a lead seal, which was on the document that was signed there. In the Council of Whitby, the representatives of the Roman Catholic Church met the representatives of the Celtic Church, mainly from Scotland, and pushed up through Northumbria into Scotland. And the Theodore, the fellow that was from Rome, like everyone who fights something he can't understand, was sarcastic, was derogatory, was disdainful, was proud. He says, you few people in the corner of the earth, are you going to argue with Jerusalem and with Rome and with Antioch? That's where all the brains are. That's where all the wealth is. That's where all the real knowledge is. Do you think you know things that we don't know? Are you going to set right all the doctrines of this big, huge church? And he comes there in all his pompous robes and everything else, impresses them, upmanship. And when the leader of the Celtic Christians at that time saw that nobody would take a serious thought of his doctrines, they wouldn't try to refute his arguments, he gathered up his books and his parchments, walked out, went back to Scotland. Almost the same thing happened in Cornwall and Wales. Then they began to push them in Scotland. So from Scotland, they went over to Ireland. And Scots and Irish, and the Irish came from Scotland. And they were pushed over there. There were a few there, but there they found a refuge. And there they worshipped. And you can see all over Ireland, if you look, the round towers go back maybe now 1,400 years. And there are all sorts of remains of their churches. Now, when you say church, you've got to bear things in mind. Now, when the pioneers here in the United States pushed from New England, say, into Ohio, and the head of the family built a house for his family, and you read in the history book, he built his house for his family. What sort of a house did he build? How big was this thing? 2x4. With an attic you crawled up to and slept in. So when you look for these churches, you could get three of them into this room. They're tiny little churches made of stone. Tiny little churches. 20 people seating churches. They were alone. They were there in the wilderness. And so they take the plentiful stones and built up a little stone, all drywalled, still standing, and there they would worship. There they would study. They started schools. They started writing. The best illuminated books, I think, on this planet came out of Ireland. If you like to look, if you like to go to their museums and look at them, Irish illuminated manuscripts. Well, they found in Ireland a small population that had some laws of their own. And in one of the biographers, Patrick helped those old pagans, they were, to rewrite their laws, make them more humane. As one of the biographers of Patrick said, Patrick helped them to put a thread of poetry in their law. Real Celt. Celts are poets. Orators, their language, Welsh today, and in Ireland,
called gift of the gab. They can talk, they can use language very beautifully. Their bards would go out and tell all sorts of stories. Well, this Irish law, this ancient, ancient Irish law called the Cinque Mhór, gives relationships. Now, how did the Christians live? Now, if you read the modern history, these were monasteries. They established monasteries here and there. You know, you can mutilate truth with words. Archaeologists have digged around the cemeteries and the trash places. In the cemeteries, they found skeletons of babies and children and women and girls and men. Monasteries. They were communities. They were communities founded on the cities of refuge. Everything was biblical. They'd live in a little walled community. Then they would have their fields outside in the suburbs. And the Cinque Mhór covers that. They cover that. They talk about the fields of the people and the fields of the Christians. They've got it all arranged, all out there. Another biographer discusses the worship that Patrick had every seventh day. Every seventh day. He got a visitor from a friend of his that came from Belgium once. It wasn't called Belgium then. But they had great sweet communion every seventh day. And you look in the Cinque Mhór, and there's ideas of tithe, there's ideas of Sabbath keeping, the laws that came out of the Liber Ex Lege Moisi about relationships, sexual relationships, and relationships to property. They gave the tithe to the church, as they call this community, the Christians. Hinted at in all sorts of ways. And there was when the heathenism took over here, in Europe and in England, the torch still burned in Ireland. Then she says, in the 500s, they began to come across. They began to feel a missionary urge. And she mentions Columba. Now, Columba established himself in Ireland, in Iona. Iona's north of Glasgow, on the extreme western coast of Scotland. It's a little island. Tiny little island. 1 mile long. Not a mile long. A few hundred yards wide. Little hill, maybe up 100 feet on it. No trees that you didn't plant. Just fields where you could keep sheep. And there they built their little stone houses. And the distance to Scotland was just a few hundred yards. At all, but there they were. One of the kings of Scotland was persuaded to give this to Columba. Now, how did Columba get there? Now, this again is a story that they tell. It seems to have some truth. Columba wanted to make a copy of the Psalms. So he borrowed from a friend of his a copy of the Psalms and made a copy. And the friend who lent him the copy said to him, "That copy is mine." So they had a row. And so they went to court. And the Irish chief was there, and he listened to the case, and then he made his profound statement. A calf belongs to the cow that bore it. The copies belong to the owner of the original. Now, that may be the first copyright law you ever heard of. But that's what happened. And Columba was young, he was in his late teens, and he was mad, and he killed his friend. Now what was he going to do? Well, he repented very fast. And then he decided that he had to do something to compensate. He was going to become a missionary. And so he went over. They had coracles. And a coracle was measured by the number of bull hides used to make this circular little boat with a wattle rim to it, like a deep saucer. And if you've ever gone on the Irish Sea, see, the currents come in from the north, from Iceland, and the currents come in from the south through the English Channel. And they meet in the top part of the Irish Sea. And if you've ever had motion sickness, you will get the father and mother of all motion sicknesses if you try to cross the Irish Sea at almost any time. It's an extremely rough crossing. Well, they went across and they established themselves and they began to push eastward through Scotland, down into the north of England, to a place called Withorn, their remnants, across to Lindisfarne on the northeast coast, north of Northumbria. They established a settlement. And the farthest east they went was to Gallin in Switzerland and down to Bobbio in northern Italy. They also went into France, and some of their writings has been found in Würzburg in Germany. They spread right through there. Wherever they went, they preached the gospel. Now, these are the bare facts, and it's amazing what a historian can do with it. In the year 717, Nectan, king of Scotland, expelled the Christians from Iona, 717. Now that statement, King Nectan expelled brethren, fratres, from Iona, trans, across the hills of Hibernicum. 9 words. That's in the writings for the annals. See it right there. Check it. That's what happened. It's like a diary they kept. And it's amazing, the annals of Ireland, the annals of Scotland, how detailed, year by year by year by year by year, hundreds of years. Now, if you had those 9 words in Latin, how many chapters of a history could you write? Now, you'd be surprised at the numbers of chapters that have been written. What is the mountain of Scotland? Dozens and dozens of articles. Grampians? Could be. What happened? You don't know. He just expelled them. Did he slaughter them? Well, you can make quite a case out. So when you begin to read the history of this, remember the footnote. And don't let yourself be too carried away. What I'm embedding in your brain is a suspicion. Orange light that goes in your mind whenever you read history or theology that anywhere questions the Bible or the spirit of prophecy. Careful. Anyway, they were gone. In their place, they put other brethren. See, they'd become Catholics in between. 664, they gobbled up the Christians in England. 717, they gobbled up the Christians in Ireland, in Scotland. It wasn't until 900 that they finally gobbled up the Christians, few remaining ones in Ireland. Now this is the broad story of the history. Now look how she said it here. Primitive Christians, untouched by Romans. Saxons came to Britain. Christians were forced to retreat. A century later, Columba came to Iona, kept the Sabbath, crossed over England, Germany, Switzerland, even Italy. Trace them, map them. Bobby or Molly and I have gone on this pilgrimage. We went to Gallin. Trouble is, when you see how the Celts lived, and then you see in Saint Gallen in Switzerland today, the church they have built there, monstrosity. Big as a football field, full of carvings and idols, images, banners, just big, huge medieval Catholic church. Nothing to do with the Celts. But that was a sight. That's all you can say. Everything else is gone. In Bobbio, by the way, they found many centuries ago a piece of writing. Wherever Celts go, they wrote. It's called the Muratorian Fragment. Maybe you've never heard of it. If you study the history of the Bible, this fragment lists the books of the Bible in order, indicating again that the Celts were interested in the Bible. Now she says, Rome fixed her eyes. In the 6th century, her missionaries undertook. The emissaries of Rome browbeat the early Christians. If you will not receive us as brethren, you will have to put us up with enemies. We'll make war. As Bede said, they destroyed them. And so these early Christians in Britain, these Celtic Christians, whose doctrines and way of life were untouched by Romish, what does she say here? Romish apostasy, were gobbled up. For all intents and purposes, by 850, they were gone. Few here surviving. But they have left writings. Now, what about their beliefs? Now, she says here they were untouched by Romish apostasy. How could you check this? That was the question. Now, historians say much about it, but where did they get it from? Wilkinson says about it, and he quotes some historians, but to establish it, you've got to go back to the historians that he quotes and find out what their sources were. That was the fun. You had to get material written in Old Irish. Well, Old Irish stopped being spoken about 825 or 850. Old Irish, like Old English and Middle English and English today. So Old Irish, what could you get in Old Irish? Now this is how evidence is preserved, and it's always thrilled me in this kind of study. God has got techniques. He wants to establish it. He leaves his footprints, Gentry says. He leaves his evidences wherever he wants to go. 100 years ago, suddenly became fashionable to study Old Irish. Nationalism. See, after the war, Norway decided they were going to talk Norwegian. We're not going to have these solecisms that come in from Germany and Sweden and English, these barbaric countries. We're going to talk pure Norwegian. We're going to teach it in school. Where did they get pure Norwegian from? Iceland. Nobody had touched them. So that's where they studied it. They have revamped their Norwegian, much to the sorrow of the Ellen White publications, who had all Ellen White translated into Norwegian 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago. But after the war, they were going to have, so it had to be retranslated. So this vogue in learning Old Irish required readers. And then students of this area began to gather together all the material that they could find in Old Irish and translate it into English so you get the meaning and read it. So you get it in Old Irish, you get it in English. And they found in Würzburg in Germany a commentary in Latin on a commentary written by Pelagius. Have you got any church history in your mind? Pelagius was the bête noire of Augustine of Hippo, 300 plus. Pelagius was a Welshman. Pelagius is his Latinized name. He was a Welshman. He was a Celt. And he came up in North Africa and he preached the Old Gospel. And the Old Gospel that he preached contained the Sabbath. So he was a Judaizer by that time. So whenever you read in old church history that somebody is accused of being a Judaizer, he's keeping the Sabbath. Sure sign. And then when you keep the Sabbath, you know what you are? You're a legalist. That's the next slur.